So, I'll be gone from the retreat tomorrow for the opening of the chaplaincy program. And it's something very touching for me sitting here at this moment to be here at this retreat with all of you and having had the connection with you, the practice discussions and your practice, and having some connection and some sense of the retreatants online and how they've been touched by this and how sincerely they've been practicing. It's quite an amazing event we're doing, and I believe that this practice here touches on the deepest places in our hearts and our minds, that some of the most important places. And as we go through this kind of meeting of ourselves, meeting ourselves in a deep way, we encounter so much of our, of everything, all of life. They talk about the full catastrophe, and probably in one way or other, each of us has had our whole catastrophe of a life with challenges of all kinds. And I still remain still in awe when I meet people, talk to people who I don't know that well, and find out a little bit their history. And how deep it's touched them. Certainly some of the amazing challenges that people have in their lives, difficulties. Also some of their capacity for love and for connecting to others and in such deep ways. So it's kind of to be here with all of you and share this place where we share in this meeting that can be so deep, and over the years it gets kind of fuller and fuller, or deeper and deeper, what we're touching here. So the hope that we care for each other, because we don't know what the person next to us is going through, and sooner or later they go through everything. Or the person in front of you, what they're going through might be that this is the retreat their mother dies. So who knows what this is all about, this amazing world of ours. And so the chaplaincy program is a place to, that is meant to touch in some explicit way, overt way, the places of these depths of the human life, just like we're doing it here in a different way. So it's really quite wonderful for me. And I feel for me it enriches this, that every year we do this, begin the chaplaincy program, it kind of contextualizes, enriches my connection to this retreat. So anyway, so tomorrow is that day, and it's part of this retreat in a sense. So now you know explicitly that that's the kind of the circle. So we have all these circles, and now with the online people, we have wider circles, and they go around the globe and people all over. So I just love that we have all this. Yeah, that I kind of like, even though we call this a retreat, we seclude ourselves, we go in silence, we don't have news and that much connection with the wider world. In a different, in a non-conventional way, it's all here. The whole world is here with us in so many ways. And this gives us a chance to touch it in a way that sometimes we can't, when conventionally we're out there with everything that's out there, and we know it, but maybe we're not as touched by it. We know it, but we don't touch it from the depths of who we are. Maybe we don't touch it with our freedom. So we're talking about this last tetrad, the foundation for mature Buddhist practice, and the foundation being these three things in Pali: viveka, viraga, and nirodha. Conventionally in English, it's called seclusion, dispassion, and cessation. Generally, these three words are not particularly inspiring for people who speak English. There's probably some exception, but I don't think they're as inspiring as these words are in the Indian context, where they're speaking them in Sanskrit or Indic languages. I think that they are evocative of a deep emotional connection to a religious life, a spiritual life. And so I like to think of kind of equivalence I told you a little earlier, and this seclusion thing, which the way I talked about it yesterday was not quite seclusion, but to use the common translation in English. Viveka, I might be nice to translate it as independence. Partly, connecting it to something which does have much more evocative feeling and sense and association for many English-speaking people, especially in the United States. So independence, then we have to explain what kind of independence we're talking about. Independence from from our clinging. Not independence from any limitations on our clinging. Which I think that's how sometimes it's understood. And viraga, this passion, I think it works well for me to call that freedom. That it's freedom from greed, hate, and delusion, these so-called passions that cause so much suffering in the world. And so we're viraga, the end of it, the fading away of it. So freedom, independence and freedom. And then the third, nirodha, you can see, go to the block party and say, what are you into in Buddhism? Oh, we're into cessation. Oh. Can you say more about that? Oh, the ending of things. Oh. Well, in the old days in English, I mean, that's 100 years ago, they called it extinction. Extinguishing. Oh. And that conversation comes to full cessation with your neighbor. So, is there an English word that might work better? And so, you might have your own idea for an English equivalent, but I like peace. So, independence, freedom, and peace. The practice, when it becomes mature, is based on, or is founded on, or is supported by a direct connection with independence, not being dependent on anything, a direct connection to freedom, and a direct connection to peace. One of the characteristics of these three is that they kind of represent, each of them are different angles or different expressions or something of kinds of absences. That the independence is independence from clinging, the absence of clinging. Freedom is also an absence of clinging, but the absence of greed, hate, and delusion, perhaps, to fill it out. And the peace is an absence of conflict, absence of war, absence of agitation. They each of them represent an absence of something that's very significant, very important. So this way that mature practice is based on something, it also can be based on a palpable, or I don't know what the right English words are now anymore, but a direct connection a person can have to a sense of absence that is available, that's somehow in the picture, somehow in the field. The absence, something has stopped, something has ceased, something has is no longer there. And that absence, people sometimes like to champion the value of being attuned to space, spaciousness. And that's nice, and it's very wonderful at times. But the problem with that is that space kind of is more something than absence. And so it's easy to get attached to it or kind of have some kind of... But absence is more absent in my mind than space. And I mean, it's really absent. And... and so it's kind of like the open door, the open window. That's you kind of know it's there, know it's available, know it teaches you something. It teaches you you can get out of the room whenever you want. Because the door is open. So you know this absence is here that shows you that non-clinging is available. That there is an alternative to greed, hate, and delusion. There is another way of being in the world, being with our experience, that doesn't assert self into the picture. Remember at the beginning of the retreat, I talked about asserting the self is delusion. Being informed by all things is awakening, is liberation. So this absence that, you know, the absence of conceit, absence of arrogance, absence, this is an absence which is so full of all the things that it's absent of. And I think that to go through the practice and work through and meet ourselves and see all these different places we get caught and maybe struggle with it and work with it and come to the other side of it where you come to an absence of it, it's kind of like we're filling that absence with more and more nothing. More and more association, more and more richness, more kind of like, oh, this too can go. This too, I don't have to get caught. There's an alternative to. So to have some personal feeling from this practice, and you're welcome to very different words or concepts for what it means for you, but this absence of clinging, of grasping, of craving, of hatred, or fear. Maybe independence, freedom, peace. To have some sense of that. But even something that's even more wonderful, more happiness producing, which is kind of, yes, that there's freedom and independence and peace, but this absence is Even those things are not there. Wow. I mean, wait a minute. I was with you as long as you said it was independence, freedom, and peace. I mean, I can ride home to, you know, my friends and say, look what I have. But this independence, this absence of everything, that is just glorious, but there's no glory. It's luminous, but there's no light. It's boundless, but it is nowhere. And are we just, in this absence, are we just left with nothing? Are we just kind of going to be kind of wimps? Buddhist wimps? Not asserting the self is delusion. Asserting the self is delusion. But maybe that was a proper slip. Maybe not asserting something can also be a delusion. Holding back and resisting and suppressing who we are. Deflating ourselves, making ourselves small, apologizing for ourselves, feeling like we're not important. You know, so the people who have no problem with, they don't assert themselves, but they are in this kind of undermining way, it's backward way. So both are delusion. So what's the alternative? Is there another way? So I want to read you a sutta where one of the places where it talks about practicing on the foundation of independence, freedom, and peace, maturing in, they say, and they translate it as relinquishment, but the word also means gift. Maturing in a gift. Wow, isn't that great? I just love it. Who's the gift for? That's a koan. And in this particular passage, based on these three things, it's the Eightfold Path. So each factor of the Eightfold Path, supported by Viveka, Viraga, and Nirodha. And what's significant about this passage, is that sometimes the Eightfold Path is seen as a beginner's practice, introduction to Buddhism practice. But here, all eightfold steps of the path are the practice of those who have attained a serious maturity in the practice. And the Eightfold Path is still what they practice, or to say it perhaps more to the point of how the text talks about it, they're not really exactly the practices, but the expression, how they live, their expression of their life, that is based on independence, freedom, and peace. So anyway, but here's this wonderful, so it starts with an analogy. And this is what I want to say, analogy, which I think is so evocative and so interesting, I think. Based upon the Himalayas, so the word based here, founded on, supported by, is the same word as being based on seclusion, dispassion, and cessation. So based on the Himalayas, the king of mountains, the Nagas, So I apologize for referring to you all as snakes. That some of you probably wouldn't take that well. Who sheds their skin. But here the Nagas are serpents. So now you've graduated, because you're the one who's being, and the analogy is supposed to apply to you here. So now you're these, the Nagas are these powerful creatures, which apparently are benign, that live in the ocean. And usually, based upon the Himalayas, the king of mountains, the Nagas nurture their bodies and acquire strength. When they have nurtured their bodies and acquired strength, they enter the pools of the mountains. From the pools, they enter the lakes, then the streams, then the rivers, and finally they enter the ocean. There, they achieve greatness and abundance of the body. Expansiveness of the body. Isn't that a great, beautiful image? So too, based upon virtue, established upon virtue, a practitioner develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path, and thereby attains greatness and abundance in wholesome mental states. This is not an example of absence. This is not an example of like, yeah, do this practice, you'll be completely empty. You'll realize emptiness, you'll be empty, you'll be nobody. No one will see you. This is an example of kind of a power, of strength, of bigness, of abundance. I mean, wow. Does that have a role in Buddhism? And how does a practitioner do this? Here, a practitioner develops right view based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing and release. And then it does the same thing for all the other factors of the Eightfold Path. It is in this way that a practitioner, based upon virtue, established upon virtue, develops, cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path, and thereby achieves greatness and abundance in wholesome mental states. So this kind of maturity is someone who has experience, knows about the absence. That's how you understand viveka, viraga, and nirodha. That's how you understand independence, freedom, and peace. And at the same time, practicing in reference to this absence of clinging allows something to grow inside of us, to develop, that we become mighty Nagas. Watch out. You might be bigger and more powerful than you ever imagined. This tradition, at least the ancient one, the ancient Buddhist one, does not seem to be a tradition that is championing a certain kind of self-effacement or diminishing of the self or diminishing who we are or whatever we want to say here. But rather, there's something, there's a dignity and certain royalty and naga serpent-like quality of these people who are committed to virtue, committed to a life of harmlessness. Sometimes the image of a harmless person is someone who's maybe weak and meek, but here the image of a harmless person is someone who has power, strength, has abundance. And the combination of that, of really showing up and being present here fully, being able to stand on your own two feet, be able to meet unapologetically, not needing to defend oneself or prove oneself, or assert oneself, but also not diminish oneself. Just here. Fully here, so that you feel the fullness and maybe you feel the emptiness together with it. The fullness of the being and the lack of clinging, lack of attachment to self, lack of conceit. So this image of the naga, the serpent, I think is a very significant image to represent the maturation of practice, kind of, because it's possible that I know a lot of Buddhists in the West who kind of have this diminishing them kind of view and to be gentle. We're supposed to be, you know, we're supposed to specialize in metta and kindness, and which is pretty wonderful. But I think some people who do it give up their strength, give up their ability to show up because they're being so careful with everyone, and which is good to be careful, but not at the expense of making yourself smaller. So this image, so then if you go to the commentaries, ancient commentaries that explain this analogy, they say this, they explain what's going on. That normally these majestic, big, powerful serpents live in the ocean. But when they're getting ready to give birth, I guess the little nagas are in danger in the ocean. They can get eaten by creatures and something. So they go up, they travel up the rivers and creeks and everything to the highest places in the Himalayas, the king of mountains, where they're far from the predators, and give birth up there. And up there, these little baby serpents get fed and grow and develop. And then they, when they're big enough, they go into little pools of water and swim around and get stronger, and they continue growing. And then they go into lakes that are even bigger to hold them. And then they go into streams and start flowing down the mountain. Then they go into rivers and continue flowing, and the rivers flow, you know, like the Ganges goes across the plains of India and eventually gets to the ocean, where they can do naga things. And so it's kind of like this image of a parental image of care for the young, protecting the young, to raise them in some safe place. It's kind of touching. And then grow and grow. And then this analogy is explained. They're based on the Himalayas, just as a practitioner is based on virtue. Virtue is the king of mountains that we have to go to be safe. When we first come to practice, we're the little serpent. And there's so many dangers in this world for us that we want to kind of be in a safe place. And so rather than it being a literal place, it's our virtue. And then we practice. And we go into these beautiful, refreshing ponds and pools of water. Some of you know that pools of water, lakes, are analogies for the jhanas, mountain lakes, for concentration. But it doesn't have to be just jhana. Just we, the Dharma practice, we start immersing yourself in this beautiful, peaceful kind of environment of our kindness, of our compassion, of our collectedness, the unification of mind, centered, resting here. A place where we get conditioned and influenced by all this goodness, all this healthy kind of good feelings kind of helps us to grow and develop further. And when you're at some point, then we say we enter the stream and practice. And stream enters. And so here you have, at some point, the nagas get big enough, they enter the stream. And they're carried down, and that stream gets bigger and bigger, and becomes a river. And then it goes out to our, here, for the Nagas, maybe their primary home. It's kind of like a homecoming, to come back to the ocean. The ocean, I don't know about the ancient India, what kind of idea they had of the ocean, but I wonder if it would like, I mean, I imagine it was like, their sense of the ocean was probably bigger than our sense. Like, I don't even know if they had ideas of limits, how big the ocean was, maybe. But so then we come home to into freedom, independence, and peace. So we all started as baby Nagas, relying on virtue. In the beginning, we get to go in the kiddie pool and practice and be safe. And then the pool gets bigger and a lake, and we learn to swim and dive and all kinds of wonderful, have fun. And then at some point when we're ready, we can enter the stream. Smaller streams. Actually, the word for river here seems to be roaring rivers. So not just a peaceful, but, you know, rivers are roaring, lots of loud. So maybe there's some power in the rivers, too, that they're being carried by, and maybe there's speed. And eventually they make their way to the ocean, where they can be... where we can be, we achieve greatness and abundance. All that from nothing. All that from absence. All that from, at least in this regard, based on independence, freedom, and peace. So imagine that you have a direct connection to this kind of freedom that we're talking about here. And that you don't have to diminish yourself. You don't have to reduce yourself. You don't have to pretend that you somehow don't exist because there's no self. You're supposed to disappear, ideally, and not really be here. But rather, your freedom that you now know something about is expressed through you getting to be yourself in your fullness, just as you are. You don't have to look like anybody else's fullness, anybody else's abundance of just being themselves. But as you do this practice, the direction we're going is in this freedom that it provides, is to become more and more yourself. Which for most of us means shedding the skin of a lot of things which is not ourselves, that we thought was ourselves. Personalities that have been acquired, personalities and dispositions that are brought about by the influence life has had on us. The constructions we build, the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. So who you end up being at the end of this process of practice might not be the one you think you are. But still, you become yourself fully. You're not going to be anybody else. And I remember once when someone said, maybe it was Suzuki Roshi or someone, or it's this paraphrase, and when you are you, the Dharma is the Dharma. Maybe he said, when you are you, Zen is Zen. So we'll borrow it. When you are you, the Dharma is the Dharma. And we find in the ancient tradition, in the early teachings, there are a few places where the Buddha equates Dharma with self. It actually uses the word self there, which you're going, well, we're not supposed to use that word. And it's a famous story. When he was about to die, getting close to it, he said, make yourself an island. Make yourself an island. Make yourself a refuge of yourself with no other refuge. And then he goes immediately and says, make the Dharma your island. Make the Dharma your refuge with no other refuge. So he says, no other refuge. But he says these two different things. The only way to reconcile these is if self and Dharma are the same. Isn't that a nice koan? That you become the Dharma when you become yourself. Really yourself. After a few layers of coats have been taken off. So this process we've done these 3 weeks of, you know, going through these triads represents that a movement in a river, the flow, a growing, a changing, and an evolving process that we're in always. We're always in an evolving process. Life is an evolving process. But you can, it's possible to put yourself in a good current. It's possible to put yourself in a good river. If the Nagas go up at the top of the Himalayas and they go, maybe if they don't go on the south side of the Himalayas but decide to go down a river on the north side into, I don't know where, eventually ends up in the, you know, close to the Silk Route desert. That doesn't work for them so well. So you have to put yourself in the right river, in the right place. So and this is what this teachings for these weeks have been about how to put yourself and engage in the healthy, proper river so you can be yourself fully and freely. So I'll end this talk with a suggestion for a task, practice. When you're most, not most, when you're, as you keep practicing for the next day or so, maybe as you get quiet, what might you let go of so you can be more yourself? Thank you.